acronym CEO has 506 different meanings. The Urban Dictionary provides meanings such as gutting everything out, cool English only, or controlling every objective. But let's be serious. Everyone who listens to this podcast should immediately connect CEO with Chief Executive Officer, or the big boss of a company. Despite this immediate connection, we know fairly little about CEOs. Do we know how the day of a CEO looks like? Or is the difficulty of being a CEO that there is no regular day? How does a CEO make a decision? How does a CEO look at the finance department? Does a CEO rely on accounting information to make decisions? In this podcast, we will try to provide an answer on these and many other questions. My name is Bart Tierink, and I'm hosting the podcast today with my colleague at Tilburg University, Philip Jools. Philip, how have you been since the last podcast we made with Mary Bart?
Pretty good. Thanks, Bart. Since the start of this academic year, we moved back to on-campus teaching. And that's really a great feeling. You have direct contact with your students and your colleagues. And I'm actually very happy that we have this very vibrant campus back these days. So I hope it will remain like this for the months and years to come.
I think I hope the same. So let's hope together for that. So today we are sharing the podcast table with Erwin van Laatem. Let me maybe first introduce Erwin. Erwin started his career as road transport manager at Shell and moved up to Vice President Supply Chain Europe. He continued his career at Essent, which is a leading energy company in the Netherlands. He was the CEO of Essent Belgium for 5 years and CEO of Essent the Netherlands and part of the executive committee of the mother company Innogy, which is now called E.ON. After his career at Essent, Erwin became the CEO of Van de Velde. Van de Velde is a Belgian listed company active in women's lingerie, sports and swimwear, and well known for the brands Marijo, Primadonna and Andres Sarda. Since 2021, Erwin is Chief Commercial Officer of Scone, which is an AI-driven platform supporting firms and individuals on the path towards net zero. Erwin, many thanks for accepting our invitation and welcome in our podcast. Have you done podcasts before?
It's actually the first one, Bart and Philip, so thank you for the invite and trusting your guidance to provide us with this new experience for myself.
Are you a little bit nervous?
A bit nervous, not sure what's coming up, but we'll see.
That's often the best start for a podcast. So in the first part of our podcast, we typically look back at the career of our guests. The best way to do that is checking LinkedIn. I checked your LinkedIn and I saw that you graduated as an electrical engineer. Finally, you made it up to the CEO level. Was that like always your career plan when you graduated?
No, it was not the plan, Bart, actually. When I made my choice between medicine and then electronics engineering, at the time, let's say mainframe computers, PCs, etc. came up. And I actually wanted to do something which I did not know yet, which was new, but never really aspired a technical career, more international and a commercial career. So after graduation, I continue to do fundamental research in medical imaging, a lot of data. Again, it's now a lot about data, a lot of data and technology. At the same time, I did my MBA. So during the day, I did my MBA, and in the evening, I worked on the research.
Okay. Well, so and then let's say you like at Shell, for instance, you still were.
Yeah. So and then I actually wanted to broaden and international. So. At the time, I sent out 40 letters to companies. It was still letters, no email yet. And Shell was the first one to respond. So I was a part of the commercial generalist career at Shell. So where in 18 years' time, I did about 7 very different jobs. So mm-hmm. Jobs of about 2 to 3 years. You were tested on one dimension. And when you started to know what you were talking about, you kind of were tested on something else. And so I started off at road transport management, which was quite an operational and heavy job, hazardous goods transport. Was then picked up by London to do market entry. Mm-hmm. So in countries where Shell did not have any activity yet or only production. I established commercial companies. I spent 6 months in China, 3 months in India, 2 months in Pakistan. A great experience. Then I was asked to operationally run the big retail sites along the highways, which is basically running supermarkets. It's retail, it's oil and gas, but it's basically retail supermarkets. And spent time in merger and acquisitions, talking about finance and the whole valuation, etc. Merger and acquisitions did a few deals before becoming responsible for the commercial activities in the Netherlands, so which is a home market for Shell, so quite important, quite a lot of exposure and reputation to manage. Before then, ending up at supply chain, which was a big turnaround. When it was announced, people said, "Well, it's a mess across the board. Can you do it?" So I asked, "Okay, can I have a bit of time of reflection?" And my then boss said, "Yeah, but not too long because we want to announce this afternoon." So I said, "Okay, let's do this." Which was a tough job, but I learned a lot. It's usually in the toughest jobs that you have the steepest learning curve and learn a lot of skills. So that was the part at Shell. Yeah.
But then you, let's say, you then move to Ascent, and at Ascent you go to the CEO level. Like, that decision to become a CEO or to jump there, is that like, did you also need reflection to do that?
Right. I must say, all these jobs kind of happened to me, or I was looking for the job. So either the challenge came to me, or I was attracted by the challenge. I think it was a little bit of both. Actually left Shell because there was no job anymore at my level in Europe. Jobs were being globalized. I spent a lot of effort and sacrifice turning around this supply chain. And at the time, Jeroen van der Veer was CEO. I said, "Okay, but I want to have my fair share of the high value, high complex deals." I had experience in making end-to-end deals. So he asked me to set up the commercial academy at Shell, where I basically said, "Okay, I mean, I can do this, but not too long, because I know I become very enthusiastic and I really want to have the line jobs where I can make internal and external impact." And the then CEO of Ascent, he basically said, "Oh, Erwin, if you can do market entry in China and India, perhaps you can do market entry for Ascent in Belgium as well. And if you start with us, it's my job to make you stay," and the then CEO said. And then very quickly, it appeared, we were in the middle of the liberalization of the energy market. Mm-hmm. I think the theme in my career is very much change and transformation. Mm-hmm. So with the deregulation of the market, freeing up of the market, there was a lot that needed to happen. So I was asked to then lead the commercial business of Ascent in the Netherlands. Ascent was just bought by RWE. The customer portfolio was loss-making. There was very bad reputation, broken processes for the whole sector, low profitability. So we were losing about 30,000 customers per month, which is a whole village per month. So I was actually put in charge of the customer portfolio and turned that around in 2.5 years' time. And again, I did not do that on my own. So it's with a whole team of really dedicated people. But let's say after 2.5 years, Ascent as a market leader and an incumbent was growing again against the market. Gaining customers as an incumbent with top scores on customer satisfaction, as well as a healthy profitability. Mm-hmm. And because that was so successful and was kind of groundbreaking in the Dutch market afterwards, I dare to say a lot of companies kind of followed the same path or tried to do so. My boss, the then CEO of Ascent, got promoted, and I kind of took his position into Ascent. So that's why I say it's more or less happened to me.
Yeah. If we look at your career until then, did you do a lot of commercial transformations, let's say. In doing that, did you benefit from your engineering background, which is much more technical? You know, like if we talk with our students, they want to do those commercial jobs. You know, they want to do commercial transformations, and so they then, you know, they follow certain degrees, master degrees, which are focused on management, marketing, whatever. But did you benefit from your engineering background in doing these commercial transformations?
Absolutely. I think in all these jobs, what was also there was actually implementing IT systems. Mm-hmm. So which means also that you need to streamline the processes, which also has relation to the financial process on administrative organization, internal controls, etc. And so having a sound technical IT electronics engineering basis makes me has allowed me to understand what are the commercial applications of technology, or how can technology enable you to capture commercial opportunities. And that's especially the case, of course, in a digital age where you have connected customers, you have a connecting technology, where a company needs to be transformed much more in a more connected way than 30 or 40 years ago, where you could do that more or less sequentially. So the commercial applications of technology are really important nowadays with machine learning, artificial intelligence, etc. So I think it's vital that at board level, people gain understanding of technology, especially digital, machine learning, artificial intelligence, etc., to make the best informed decisions.
Okay. So Erwin, as a CEO, you moved from Ascent, the company you described, to Van der Velde. So you basically moved from the energy sector to a company in the clothing industry focusing on women's underwear. And that looks to me like a big shift. But is it really a big shift for you? And I mean, what are the motivations actually to make this the shift?
Yeah, I always say with a smile, from energy to lingerie. Eh? That's that's a rhyme. Well, I mean, Van der Velde came to get me. Eh? So they were. I was actually, I just left Ascent Innogy. I was active together with Jan-Willem Rombouts, who will come back in the story later on, who at Restore on-demand response. I'll pick that up later on. And at Van der Velde, there was a change of CEO and CFO at the same time, which is quite impactful. And the family shareholder actually wanted to change the business model, moving away from, let's say, a dying retail channel of mom-and-pop stores selling lingerie, to an omni-channel and more digital market approach. And so based on my experience, they came to get me to make that growth possible. However, what I saw after a few months was that it more a business recovery than a growth. So the company had to be transformed about 360 degrees, as well the supply chain processes, as the whole IT, which had been neglected for a lot of years, where all the process needed to be streamlined, made transparent, in order to really be impactful in the market and put, let's say, the customer at the center of an omni-channel experience. So for me, there was a lot of portable skills that I took along on supply chain, on retail, on digital, on processes, how to bring the organization back into control, etc. But it was a different product, that's for sure.
Yeah, so because if you look at that, you worked for Shell, Ascent, very international companies, global, and then you moved back to a Belgian company. Of course, it's a listed company, but with a big family shareholder. Was that also like a big step, or was that different to manage such a company, especially the Belgian?
It was an international company, yeah. With activities in the US and East Asia, Hong Kong, Dubai, etc. I think, quoting one of the shareholders, it's also a large SME. So with all the pros of entrepreneurship, but also all the contrasts of, I mentioned the processes and the controls and streamlining and efficiency. What I learned there was indeed the elements of a family business. So I spent most of my career outside Belgium, and mainly in the Netherlands, or out of the Netherlands, which is a different culture of working compared to the deep Flanders, where you have, I mean, incredible craftsmanship, but also a certain culture, the lack of international, etc. And then also family business, which has got different governance or different dynamics in the governance compared to what I was used before, even in family business in the Netherlands. So that was for me a change. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot there, let's say. Yeah.
And so, like you mentioned that craftsmanship, but that's like a positive thing, but it's like there's also like a flip side to it. Like, how did you manage that? I think that's a lot of Belgians are proud. Like, you know, we have craftsmanship. We work hard. We work like, you know, nearly 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. We deliver excellent products.
Yeah.
But there's also a flip side to that, in the sense that they are like less.
Yeah.
Less
so open. What I would say it's when I see people as a native Belgian, people then ask me what is, and I'm in a bad position to say what's the difference between Netherlands and Belgium, because I don't see it anymore. So I've worked out 35 years out of the Netherlands. My partner is Dutch. But what I do see is a lot of complementarity. Also, when I established Benelux organization, so indeed there's some technical depth which you, on average, you find more in craftsmanship. You find more in Flanders. There's some commercial and a perspective, international perspective on the world, which on average you find more in the Netherlands. So, I've worked best with international teams, Benelux teams, where the whole is actually larger than the sum of the parts, and they really make good impact.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can definitely see that. So, one of like the questions in the introduction was also, and I'm really curious about this, by the way, how does the day of a CEO look like? And I would think that no day is the same, especially if I hear you talking now, but could you give us some insights into your tasks as a CEO, but also how do you spend your time? How does a day of a CEO look like?
Yeah, what it looks like can be very different what it should look like or you want it to look like. First of all, I think it's the best job there is, huh? I experience it that way, in a sense that you can really make an impact if you give it a go. So I'll first talk internally. So I think that the task of a CEO is really to uncover the purpose of an organization. So people buy not what you sell, but why you sell it to them, as Simon Sinek. So uncover the purpose of the organization and really be the connector across departments. As well as making sure that there's a healthy culture. And an important part of that is attracting, developing and retaining, let's say, the talent. So your future, basically. So that I would say is the most important things, making an impact internally. And then externally is to really have a positive impact on people and direction, on stakeholders and on direction. So I was also lucky, I would say, when I started as CEO of Ascent, I was advocating a regulatory environment which would last longer than the legislation of a government. Because each time there's a government, there's a change of plans, whatever. So if you go for energy, long-term investments, I mean, it holds you back. And kind of, it was contributing to a story which was already there, but at a certain stage, Wiebe Dreyer was then head of the SER. He took the initiative to lead the energy agreement in 2012, 2013, with about 47 stakeholders, so NGOs, environmental companies, employers, unions, etc. And so there I learned a lot around how can you collectively make an positive impact, a substantial positive impact on, let's say, society. And the energy agreement was the precursor of the climate agreement of a number of years ago. So apart from what a CEO needs to do, the internally connecting people, building a shared vision, attracting, retaining, developing talent, and making sure you deliver the results through people, I think an important task is to really look after the stakeholders of your company and make positive impact. They are create an environment within which that positive impact can happen. And so it's really connecting. Somebody said it's when you reach the top floor that you need to cross the road and reach out to others, contribute to ecosystems, develop ecosystems, lead ecosystems, etc. Yeah. I'm not sure if that answered your question, what the day looks like.
So with the internal and the external, and with the internal, I was wondering, like, developing talent, attracting talent is something that a lot of companies struggle with. And also the current generation of people, let's say young people, they look in a different way to their job. Have you seen that evolving?
Absolutely. I think the purpose is key. Purpose is necessary. So people connect to a purpose with their hearts and their minds. And when you succeed with a group of people to connect to your purpose, I mean, the energy really flows. What you also see is kind of tourism in companies. So people say, I'm going to travel and then I'm going to work until I've got enough money to travel further on. Right? So it's a bit the tourists. I always compare the explorers, the tourists and the prisoners. Right? So I have to work here. I'll work here until I'm gone. And then really the explorers connecting hearts and minds. So I think it's an important part of the employee value proposition to do something really meaningful and impactful with your company. A positive impact on society, on these stakeholders. And therefore, I mean, to me, number one is actually climate and addressing climate change. And that's also why I basically shifted and took a decision to really go for Scone AI, which we'll discuss afterwards. Yeah. Yeah.
One burning question, like how, as a CEO, did you deconnect from work? I mean, we know that's all like very important. And I can imagine you work like a lot of hours as a CEO. So you need to, at some point, you need to deconnect. You know, I think as researchers, we also love our job. We love to do research and teaching, but we also like need to deconnect. How did you do that?
I think it's really that self-management and self-regulation is really important. And it is indeed lonely at the top. Right? So you the self-regulation, I think it's you can also learn it, but it could be innate in a person. So I really did gave it my utmost to make that positive impact. I mean, apart from that, there's the family and especially the children to make time for them. And then for myself, I do a lot of sports. So at the time, I did about 7 hours a week of sports. After COVID, it's a bit less. And on one hand, I've got a black belt in karate. I'm teaching sailing, but I also do yoga and meditation. So it's okay. A bit the yin and the yang.
Yeah.
Which keeps me as balanced and as healthy as possible. Yeah. Yeah, I must say COVID had a negative impact on that. So I need to get into the previous practices again. Yeah. Yeah.
But I fear you like 7 hours of sports per week. That's a number I'm going to communicate with my wife.
So yes, but Bart, I hear you do 1,000 or 10,000 kilometers on the bike commuting.
Yeah, well,
from your home to where you teach, so I think that's impressive as well. So yeah,
I'll say an average of 7 hours, which is an average could be then also like 10 hours.
Volatility can be better.
So let's go to the delving. A deeper part of our podcast where we discuss somewhat deeper certain topics. I would like to start with not surprisingly, the energy crisis, because you have had you have worked in the energy crisis for quite some time. You're currently working in at Scone, which is also related to energy. And like what we have seen is the war in Ukraine has a big impact on the world, but also have led to an energy crisis. How do you look at the current energy crisis? Was it like something was that you could have, I would not say predicted, that a risk that like always was a risk for the companies you worked for? Yeah.
Well, I mean, energy transition has been there for a long time and has actually preceding the issue around climate transition. I must say it had what happens in Ukraine and energy had a big impact on me. I remember when seeing the front page of The Economist in July, where it said winter's peril. So winter is coming, winter's peril. And having worked in the energy sector, I know what it is that prices are actually determined in summer while everybody is with 30 degrees on holiday, winter is still far away. So when I read that article, I said, wow, I mean, I still now get goosebumps. I said, well, this is really something, it will be a social societal crisis in the end. So I saw that coming. What I tried to do is, okay, Erwin, you now need to step up to the plate during summer. Try to actually gather a coalition. I had really good memories of how we did the energy agreement in the Netherlands, climate agreement in the Netherlands. So I reached out to a number of stakeholders and say, hey, the winter is coming. Now we don't feel it yet, but as from September, October, this will be really bad as far as energy prices, et cetera, is concerned. What we also did at Scone is shift our resources onto a product which would enable people to, at the same time, save money, do well for the environment by saving CO2. If you save energy, the greenest kilowatt hour or the greenest energy is the one you do not consume. It's also the cheapest. So by enabling people to save energy, they save money, they save CO2, and it's better for their well-being. And then in September, there was the study of the Economist who basically said, McKinsey, who basically said, if these prices, they continue, one out of five families will run out of savings by the end of the winter. So that really struck a nerve with me. We, let's say, did our best to also, you cannot remove the pain of these high invoices, but at least you can soften it by enabling people to save energy and at the same time also do well for the environment. So I saw that really as a critical moment in time. And I think we all see, I mean, we've lived through winter. It's still, winter is still here. And this will not go away. This will be the same next year. So people think, okay, we're now gone. I mean, also governments take different measures to support families, but these measures, they will also be gone next year. So I still see this as something which needs to be handled with urgency, and where I truly believe that we can handle this by, in the first instance, reducing demand, energy savings, cost savings, energy savings, and then shifting to renewables. But I can say something on that one later.
Yeah, so the way how we deal with that is also partially determined by what politicians do. Like, we're not gonna like look backwards. Like, but what would be like a number one thing they could do to indeed like for next year to soften the pain for many families?
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't. I think we should not look at politicians and companies, but also look at ourselves and what can I do as an individual if I. Want to change the world, I need to start with myself, a wise man said. And that's also the principle for Scone AI, by the way, so that we start with ourselves, team, organization. But there's one thing, it will take a bit of time, what I thought was really insightful, what Sven Smit, so the head of McKinsey Institute, when I was attending a conference in last October, said. I'll take just 3 minutes for that, if I'm allowed. The previous crises were more or less demand cycle crises, and we're now living a supply cycle crisis. So in a demand cycle crisis, it's about 80% psychology. Examples of demand cycle crisis, the dot-com at the end of the 90s, the credit and the financial crisis, 2008, and even COVID. You could say, okay, it's demand cycle crisis. It happens, people don't spend anymore, it's gone, people spend again. Look at what happened after COVID and at the skiing resorts, they're full. With the demand cycle crisis, we've got demand cycle crisis on three levels. One is energy, and I'll come back to energy. The second one is raw materials, cobalt for batteries, etc. And the third one is capabilities, people. I mean, how many jobs are open and people looking for work, but it's an issue around capabilities and competences. But on energy, what struck to me was his graph when he showed that oil and gas companies have been under pressure to move more sustainable, and rightfully so. So investment, their investment has decreased to about 7% growth, annual average increase, 17%, 7%. In order to compensate that decline to 7%, with renewables should grow with 14%, so twice or three times as much. However, they're growing at a lower pace than the 7%. So even if you would want to move to sustainable energy, that's just not enough. Steel companies that want to green their energy, they do not have enough green available. And there I see the distinction between talking and newspaper articles, et cetera, around energy and renewables, et cetera, and then what is being done and what is being invested. So there's a big gap in that. So what we need to do, is to create an investment climate. First of all, it starts with ourselves, an investment climate in which we have clarity of regulatory framework over the long term, and which moves us which makes a step change in investment in renewables. At the same time, also reducing the demand for energy, and especially reducing the demand for fossil fuels. Anyway, and so I think that's a fundamental difference between demand cycle crisis, supply cycle crisis. One of the relevant supply cycle crises we had was in the 70s, when there was Autoloze Zondag, and where OPEC actually increased prices, and it took about 10 to 15 years before then there were new sources of oil in Norway, gas in Scotland, etc., etc. So we're looking again at a similar thing where we need to shift from fossil fuels very urgently to renewables, and that will take years. So that's why I'm saying next winter it will not be easier than this winter, and we should actually look for sustainable solutions, invest in renewables, as well as decrease our demand on consumption in general, but especially in fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's my statement.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because what I'm wondering now, like I'm already teaching sustainability for about like 10 to 15 years, and I remember I was reading these type of things already 10 to 15 years ago. So this is... It's very interesting, but this is not something that we all of a sudden, like this knowledge that we developed like the last year since the war in Ukraine. I'm pretty sure like in companies like the ones you worked for, especially Ascent and Shell, they know these type of things. And why is it that it took such a long time before we started to act? It's a little bit human nature, of course, but...
I mean, we should act even more. So there's a clear urgency on addressing climate. So for who do we do it? I mean, we have our small blue planet, and what we do know is that we will all leave it dead once. So we will leave it dead. Yeah. So how do we make the most of our time here on our little blue planet? And pay forward to the next generations who need to continue to live here. So that's one thing. I would say we can look at government, we can look at companies, we all individuals. In one context, I'm an individual. In another context, I'm an executive of a company. In another context, I'm a citizen and a voter for a government. So we bear a lot of responsibility on ourselves and. I think we should ask ourselves as individuals, what do I do every day, every morning, every day, and what have I done at the end of the day in order to make this world a little bit of a better place? And what can I do individually, but also not neglect the power of, let's say, again, quoting The Economist, so in April last year, we said, okay, if the whole of Europe, or it was actually the International Energy Agency, if the whole of Europe would turn down the thermostat for 1 degree, it would mean the difference of 1 month of Russian gas imports. Now, let's do this. I would say, well, it's a small thing. Well, what can I do in the whole? But if the whole of Europe does it, it's 1 month of Russian gas imports. So we should not underestimate the collective impact of our small, little, everyday actions. And so start with ourselves and enable, as a politician or as an executive, a climate within which, or as an investor, a climate within which these the acceleration in these renewables can actually happen.
Yeah.
And there's always these things we work, if you look at behavioral science, which we use a lot in SCONE, there's always this conflict of interests. So in myself as a human being, I have an egoistic drive, a hedonistic drive, my well-being, an altruistic drive for my fellow citizens, and something for the environment. It's where I take that decision. So, for example, my daughter is vegetarian for the environment. So that she says, okay, I'm for the environment, and it's altruistic. However, she wants to travel to Ibiza, and she does that by plane. So it's egoistic. So there's this tension between these three values in ourselves. And I think that's one of the things which explains why we talk about it. We all know that it needs to happen. But one way or another, we do not get ourselves into activation individually and collectively to actually make it happen. So I think we should first look at ourselves and then at the rest of the world and use the power that we have as an executive or as a politician to create that environment, really create and shape that environment within which these things can happen. And that's why I so much now want to put, I'm putting my shoulders under climate transition, because all the things that I've learned how to transform organizations, change and transformation in organization, be it commercial, be it digital, it should actually, and it's a real call for action to companies, politicians, students, etc., should be used for a sustainability transformation. Mm-hmm. Sustainability transformation in society, in companies, in our governments, etc. And the same principles apply. How do you move an organization from one way of working to, let's say, new way of working? Same principles apply in a sustainability transformation. Yeah. Anyway, I'm getting carried away a little bit.
But I think the conflict between the multiple selves is very interesting. I think we experience that more and more. But I, you know, I'm a positivist, so I think that people at least have more attention to these conflicts and try to solve them more towards behavior that that helps the environment. Philip?
Yeah, well, now Erwin shifts the topic a little bit from energy to accounting, because as you know, I'm an accounting professor here at Tilburg University, so for sure we cannot not talk about this this topic. And I want to hear your opinion about the usefulness of accounting data and in your life. You told us that before you became a CEO, you had several positions in supply chain management, in sales, in marketing. You also told us that you focused on realizing transformations. Digital transformations is a very good example here. But as a CEO, how did you actually deal with accounting information to make your decisions?
Yeah. I think this is a very important one, Philip, and also for executives to understand accounting data. So I did also my best by following a master in modern finance and risk, and where I had insights in all these different accounting standards. Huh? So, I think the accounting in itself, I mean, you need to count the money and then properly label it according to standards in order to know the basis of your modeling and of your decisions taking, of course. I think what we should be mindful of is not to only use it, let's say, as the rear mirror, because this is not what I've got now, but how does the past inform me on what I can actually do for the future? I've experienced in different jobs where, I mean, things were more or less in order, and then I had jobs where I had to really fly blind because the administrative organization internal controls were not sufficiently there. I would wish that also as an experience to all the students, and that they work in an environment where they need to set it straight, where it's not there, then you'll kind of understand the value of what you can do when it's actually there. I think also as what I've experienced as in an executive position, that it's important to also again create that environment within which you have proper accounting data, I would say. And I think data in itself, it's become more easy, but it's become more complicated at the same time. In order to source it, in order to have it timely, accurate, with as little latency as possible to really inform near real-time decisions. Huh? So that would be my answer to that, Philip. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But I'm very curious also, because you have a background in engineering. Yeah. So when an engineer uses accounting information, you don't come from organizations like the Big Four. You were not kind of trained as an accountant. Is it really different the way you look at that information being produced, because you say it's useful, but maybe an engineer has a different kind of view compared to someone who was trained in accounting?
Yeah, I'm certainly not totally trained in accounting. I admire people who get a lot of energy from accounting, and so I know it's really necessary to have it. I must say I saw also the, assurance being given on stuff which was not okay at all. And so where I say, how can you give assurance on that? So I also have learned the, let's say, I mean, it's a necessary but not a sufficient assurance. It's necessary but not a sufficient condition assess the health of your business. And I guess what I'm, as I said, I'm what fascinates me is the commercial applications of technology. I think it's a bit similar to what fascinates me is the commercial applications of good accounting. Eh? So right. What can you do with it? So the application rather than doing it, it's more what can you do with it?
Eh? Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, because like, I think Philip will maybe have the same experience if you have like, and I don't want to bash here, I don't want to bash engineers, definitely not. But when you have engineers in the classroom, like in an accounting classroom, then they often come in or they have something like accounting is gives us just a perfect number. But at best, accounting is an imperfect reflection of reality.
It's not an exact science, no.
It's not an exact science.
Nor is engineering, by the way.
So. Maybe that's my misconception of engineering, and that's why. So was that also like something you had to learn? Because, you know, the accounting numbers are not perfect, but still you need to make decisions based on
informed decisions. Yeah. I think it. I mean, it's not something that happens all of a sudden. I think it's the small steps where you, if you work a lot with it, that you start to interpret it. I think it's that interpretation which is... Yeah. Which is important, and it reminds me that somebody said it's a finance professional. It's a bit like wine, eh? So you mature with age, you get better with age,
and I think that's nice to hear.
I think that's true because the more years you spend, the more cycles of annual closing, making the books connect if you do acquisitions and all this stuff. The more experience, I think, the better I see it. I see that it puts finance professionals in a better position to make that interpretation. And I think it's the same thing for executives who work a lot with it. And I think that's where a CFO and a CEO or financial and commercial generalist executives make good teams because they're very complementary. So they understand each other. So there's connection on the language. So I feel as a CEO, you need to understand enough about the accounting and how to interpret, but then be complemented with a robust finance team that has different thinking and possibly is differently wired. So it's again an area where I see the whole being larger than the sum of the parts.
Yeah. I want to ask you a little bit more about the finance professional that you just mentioned. And I read some articles about the future of finance, and in these articles, a common message is that finance needs to be a better business partner. Now, since I entered accounting academia about 30 years ago, the same message was communicated by then. So based on your own experience, have we made some progress in the last few decades, like finance becoming a better business partner? And have you seen this happening actually in the companies you worked for? And maybe finally, like, can you give us some advice on for like a finance department to become a better business partner?
Yeah, I've always worked with Mike. I'm reflecting. Yeah, so finance as the business partner of choice. So basically, saying the CFO is the navigator of the CEO, and it's one team. Eh, like in Paris-Dakar, it's one team. I do recognize that narrative around becoming the business partner or be a better business partner, etc. I think that has happened. I think we should also be realizing also for a CFO or a finance professional or a CEO, the world has become more complex. So if you say VUCA, more volatile, more uncertain, more complex, more ambiguous, it goes faster, it's digital, it's data, it's everywhere. So it's the abundance and finding your way through the abundance, what is the relevant data, what are the relevant insights, which becomes much more complex compared to 15 years ago. I say that with all respect. So I think all the professionals have professionalized, but that the environment has also become more connected, so more complex and more fast-paced, etc. So hence also my statement that financial professionals should be well-versed in technology, especially digital, machine learning, forecasting, etc.
And do you actually see this in the young graduates from the universities?
Younger graduates, yes. I see this really as a gap at board level. So, I mean, I must say during COVID, one of my assignments ended, so I really took the time to take to do 1.5 years applied machine learning and artificial intelligence, including the programming in the Python, etc. So I now have a good bullshit detector for somebody who doesn't not exactly know what they're talking about compared to who know what they're talking about. But I was really happy that I did. I mean, also COVID gave me the opportunity because there was nothing else at the time. And I really had fun programming in again. But I think what I sometimes compare a little bit with in 2008, people had credit derivatives, etc., stuff on their books which they did not understand. I think it's important that executives understand, for example, machine learning in forecasting, sales and operations planning processes, and how to interpret and how to implement in an organization. Because what you typically see is that the machines are implemented, they do their job, and then somebody says, "Ah, this can't be true, I'm going to change it." So you get a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You put all this technology in place, and then, it's on the interface between machine and human being that it's still critical in order to make it go, make it succeed or not. I think that's important that people really spend time on educating themselves in that area. Not sure I've answered your question.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, because that's a little bit what we have been doing in the last few years also in our master programs here at Tilburg University, like to also in the more traditional masters like finance and accounting, to introduce more data science skills. You mentioned programming and Python. I mean, these types of skills are also quite important for our students right now.
I agree.
I also have a question, and it's a difficult question because in a way it's existentialistic about accounting research. Did you ever consult accounting papers published in the top journals as a CFO or as you weren't CFO, as a CEO, that you're like, okay, let's, you know, we need to take a decision here, whatever it is, let's look at what is published in accounting or finance journals. And you can be very honest
the answer is I don't know. Okay. So possibly I did, but I was not conscious in doing it. I don't think so, actually. I would actually rely on finance professionals who can actually bridge that for me. I think I say that with all juries, if I would be reading a paper on microbiology, I would understand a little bit about it, but I mean, I would not do justice if I would claim that I would understand a scientific article on its own. I would need to have that context in order to interpret that. I think it's important. So I can't judge and compare it, but I think it's important to do that research and look on a scientific basis to whatever we do as humans or whatever we put in place, like accounting as humans.
But still, there is like that disconnect between like accounting and finance practice and then the research that we do. How could we also bridge that? You as someone who...
The bridging, I think I firmly believe in connectivity. So that if you connect, I'll come back to the straight answer, but just to where I'm coming from. So I truly believe that the answer for any problem is actually in an organization or in a community, and that it's important to really connect parts, to connect people. And how do you connect people? By putting them together, virtual or physical, and have a dialogue, with an intent to truly understand. And so if you say, okay, there's the scientific and there's the practice, I think for both, I would say it's important that they spend time, and the necessary thing is a connecting language, same for digital, a connecting language in organization, but a connecting language, and actually look at the world through each other's eyes. And I expect, I don't know it, but I expect there a huge complementarity again, where the whole, the working together, would actually be more impactful than the sum of the parts.
Yeah, and I think this podcast already helps to look at accounting and finance practice through the eyes of someone who has worked in many companies, I think.
I would also say with the terminology, so terminology can work connecting, but can also work a little bit divisive. So just because this, it's a question to me where I say, okay, so So it makes me realize there are kind of two groups. Mm-hmm. Well, I was looking at one group from my perspective. So how do you kind of keep that connect? And very, what's very important there is to have that common language. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Let's finally move to the Scone platform. You're currently like chief commercial officer, so you're the right man to explain to our listeners what the Scone platform is.
Yeah, I will say, okay, we start with the purpose. So what we want to do is to really excel, to be the trusted companion on the path to zero, so to accelerate people, organizations, and cities on their path to zero. I work together there with Jan-Willem Rombouts, with who I worked together in the past with Restore. And so what we do, so that's the purpose, so accelerating humankind. It starts with ourselves, company, city, organization, on the path to zero. The principles that we apply are threefold. It's the cross-section of one, demand management. So the like in energy, the cheapest and the greenest kilowatt hour is the one you don't consume. So we want to reduce or shift in time the demand for CO2, for carbon, or sources of carbon like energy, mobility, red meat, etc. That's one. Second one is behavioral science. So we talked about how difficult it is. So what is the problem in addressing climate change? The problem in addressing climate change is me. And what is the most difficult thing to do there? It's actually my behavior. So how do I change my behavior? So there we rely on behavioral science. How do nudge how do I get myself nudged into different actions? So reducing demand for carbon, behavioral science. And then the third one is technology, machine learning, which enables a very personalized approach. So when I have 100 interactions with my iPhone, the machine knows me better than my best friend. After 200 interactions, better than my partner. After 300 interactions, better than myself. So who else is there to be more personalized than, let's say, the machine learning? So that's these three things we combine. And then what we do is, first of all, we provide insight in my personal footprint. So I don't know how many of the listeners, they know their personal footprint, but on average in Netherlands and Flanders, it's about 8.5 tons of CO2 per year. Mine is actually 10. It used to be 12, so I reduced by 2. But it's 8.5 tons of CO2 that gives me the insight. And then the second step is that I get curated, so personalized actions through which I can actually reduce my carbon footprint. And that's across the domains of home, energy, mobility, food, clothing, and vitality. So how to reduce it. And I can then see the impact of my own actions, but it's even better when I do this in a group. I see the collective impact on the group on all these aspects.
Maybe like also for the listeners, like it all goes via an app that is available.
We call it the platform, which is accessible through an application, which is free to download as an individual. But the real impact you actually see when you do this as a company, as an organization, or as a university, or as a city. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so where it also related, and then we come to accounting, and I can draw a parallel between, let's say, financial accounting and the CSRD accounting, or the Corporate Social Reporting Directive. I think everybody should memorize this Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive. Where we also enable a lot of the accounting for, let's say, CO2 emissions, especially in the scope 3, a bit technical, but anyway, the accounting for that, the modeling. So we make individual or we develop individual and personalized digital twins, models around your home, your mobility, or my home, my mobility, my behavior. Move to the management of that, so reducing the carbon footprint and enabling adjustments or remedial actions when it doesn't go as fast enough, or there are other hotspots that could be tackled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is fascinating is that you can connect your digital meter at home with the platform, and the more connections you have with how you generate carbon as an individual, the better the platform works.
Why we do that is that we see it also in behavioral science. If I need to introduce numbers or I need to answer things manual, etc., people don't like it, so they postpone it, and in the end you don't do it. Look at sometimes administration or your expense claims, etc. It's kind of something I have to do. So the more we can make that effortless, flawless, and seamless, the more you see people engaging on the platform. So it's quite successful in the sense that when we do a challenge, a group challenge, we see that 1 out of 2 to 1 out of 4 people have got a daily interaction with the platform. So that means that this interest of how first of all, getting educated, then getting insight, from insight, getting inspired, and from inspiration towards activation, I'm going to do something, to really seeing my impact, that it resonates with users. And we see it especially working well with when you have groups of people doing it together, you create basically a network effect. So we stimulate each other. Yeah.
So when Scone AI is a startup, I believe you started the company last year. And at what stage is Scone right now, and what steps need to be taken actually to expand Scone?
Scone almost 2 years old. That time flies, but it's our second venture. Restore was actually the clean tech deal of the year in 2018. Previous venture, so we're working with the same team, and so we learned from the past. So we make the platform very much scalable. A lot of focus on data and platform interoperability and ecosystem thinking. So we connect into corporate systems. We take data from corporate systems, smart meters, trucks, cars, etc. So that's the basis on which we started. So that means that it goes faster, let's say, than the traditional startup scale-up. And I say that with all respect. We are also much more keen in faster in partnerships. There's some stuff that we do ourselves. So the demand response, the behavioral science, the machine learning in the area of energy and mobility, and on all the rest we partner. And with ecosystems, I believe it's important you give before you get and you pay it forward. So that's important for our mindset, I would say. What needs to happen to scale further. I've been chief innovation officer. I worked a lot with startups at the other side of the table. I'm now in one. I've worked with one. Is that we need strong partners, so strong companies, and I would say CEOs, executives who truly believe, hey, here's potential to address, let's say, one of the most important challenge of our civilization, of our times. I'm going to work together to the benefit of my own company, to my own city, and to the benefit of Scone, and to the benefit of all, in order to make it used, make it scaling, and also improve it. So we very much believe in co-creation with our users. So if you shake your iPhone while using it, you can either ask a question or make a suggestion or report a problem. And we believe the product is never good enough. It's never finished. It's good enough. That's why we also launched it before winter, because we could not say, okay, after winter, in April, we've got something which is better. If the product was already good enough in September and could actually save people €800 per person per year, just by behavioral change, so not even investing anything. So those are some of the principles, but we're looking at strong partners who are really committed to address climate change. And perhaps the last one, what I believe is that, let's say if we use, again, connecting, collective human intelligence and collective human machine intelligence, we possibly will still not solve it, but we will put ourselves in a much better position to solve, let's say, climate change than if we don't. So that's where we've seek to connect with ecosystems, strong partners to move forward. Yeah.
So you indicated that running a startup is actually quite different from running like a more established company, and you switched from one to the other. And now looking back at the organization of the finance function, I mean, I can imagine that for startups, this finance function is also quite differently organized and provides has a specific function actually in the startup. Yeah. Can you enlighten us a little bit on that?
Yes. So I think Jan Willem and myself, so we've got enough executive experience to see what should be the end state of professional finance function. Currently, we're doing most of it ourselves, I would say, or we outsource to accounting agencies, etc. But as we are internationalizing, I mean, we are mindful to have. I mean, it's cash flow management. It's again, you're putting the seats for administrative organization and internal control. So we currently do that ourselves, and we're looking forward to recruit an entrepreneurial CFO in the future.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that a job advertisement?
Yeah, I mean, there's always space for talent and for committed, purpose-driven people at Scone AI. So I would welcome as well technical as commercial as finance talent, Bart.
We have some good students and alumni from Telework University, so perfect. Maybe they can apply.
Looking forward.
So, Erwin, in the last part of our podcast, we always ask our guests to name like a song, a book, a movie, a painting, whatever you want, and to tell like what your story is with that song, book, movie, painting. What is your personal story here?
Yeah, as I'm interested in a lot of areas, it's difficult to name one. I'll just name two books that I'm currently reading because I've got this Kindle thing, and then I'm reading six books at the same time. But two that I plan to finish. One is The Web of Meaning of Jeremy Kent, and what he does there. So he puts a cultural aspect to the way how we as Westerners we look at the world. So with Descartes and the reductionism. So we take a whole and we are able to put it into different parts and analyze, etc. And it has brought us a lot of value. But if you look at the connectivity which you see in Eastern cultures and in nature, etc., he makes a strong case on how to look at nature and ecosystems to make, let's say, a better world. It also makes me realize the technology which is there in nature. So like now, I mean, for wind turbines, if you shape the wing of the wind turbine like the feather of an owl, very quiet, it makes less noise, for example, or these bullet trains with the snavel of an ice bird. So there's a lot of technology in nature where we can learn a lot from to make humankind better. So that connectivity, I mean, what happens in with trees underground, etc. So I would recommend that one, Web of Meaning. It makes a lot of meaning to me, Jeremy Lent. Plan to finish it, and then the other one that I'm reading is Putin's People from Catherine Belton, where she in 2020 she actually describes what's happening in Russia, and it's not the most pleasant story, but really insightful and on current affairs. My story, I would say, what made most impact to me are my leadership trails together with teams in South Africa. Where I got to know real heroes. So, I mean, of course, Nelson Mandela I consider him as a hero and a thought leader. But you see this heroism on smaller scale, and sometimes we need to travel in order to see it. Famous quote that I use often is, it's like these astronauts that went to the moon. They say we were so focused on the moon, but it was when we looked over our shoulder, when I looked back, that I discovered something, and it was Earth. So I was looking at the moon. When I go to the moon, I look over my shoulder and discover Earth. So I discovered there a lot on this, let's say, small-scale heroism in, for example, Mamelodi, a township in Pretoria. You see 5 kilometers by five, just sheds, five-foot metal plates. Where you see people really contributing to their society. One of them was Victor Ngozi of the YMCA, who tried to build a community center which was each week destroyed by vandalism. And he was doing that, continuing that. He said, well, it's like one man pulling a chart if I do this every day, at some stage, I hope somebody will actually stop and help me. And I've got a second one and a third one and a fourth one. And where we, with our knowledge, we actually contributed to also building that community and that society. And I saw that also, and was really grateful for being allowed there within in some of these sheds, which were really nicely and well maintained. So we see also that scarcity makes a lot of creativity. When I visited the widows of the Marikana massacre in 10 years afterwards, so there were the CNN crews there reporting on it because it was 10 years ago. So through connections, we really got to talk to the people. And so what people do in very dire circumstances, how creative they are, how well they care for their home, how concerned they are for their environment, for their future generations, etc. So there was a story that also at night with campfire, looking at this deep southern hemisphere with the Southern Cross and what is it, Alpha Centauri, which makes me wonder and makes an impact on how small, but also how small we are as a human being in this universe, but also how impactful we can be in our own environment. And against changing the world starts with ourselves, my team, my family, my team, my organization. Yeah,
I think that's definitely an important message of this of this podcast, is that changing the world always starts with ourselves. So apart from that very important advice, and I think if you listen like the whole podcast, you see that it's like very important for you, that it starts with yourself, and then you can realize change. This podcast is hosted by Tilburg University. We have a lot of our students who listen to this podcast. They are all at the start of their career in a very, like you labeled it, VUCA world, but a very uncertain world. Based on like your experience, what would be your number one advice for them to build up like a good life, successful career?
Yeah, reminds me when you get a black belt in martial arts, they tell you never, always remember the spirit of the beginner, which means you're never there. You keep on learning and take that curiosity that you have in the beginning and keep on applying that while you're learning. With all modesty, my advice would be to really invest in yourself, investing your capabilities to respond to any future outcomes. Technology will evolve, the world will evolve, etc. But investing in your own capabilities in order to respond to any future outcomes of that one, and then apply these capabilities to make a positive impact on people, on your on people, could be your employees, could be your family, etc. Positive impact on people and on direction of society. Mm-hmm. That I would wish everybody, including my children.
That's a very good advice. Erin, I would like to thank you a lot for this this podcast. I think it was a very inspiring podcast, and I think we could continue for hours, but that's maybe for another podcast somewhat later. Thanks a lot for coming to our campus. Philip, thanks a lot for co-hosting this one again, and see you all next time.
Thank you.